While we get started, I'd like to call to order the February 27th meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right. Before us is the proposed agenda for today's meeting. Are there any questions or additions that anybody would like to make to the agenda? Hearing no comments, we'll move forward with the agenda as presented. Next up is the approval of the December 5th committee meeting minutes. I would entertain a motion. Moved by Mr. Ducola, second by Ms. Hines. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. So, again, good morning. Today, we are going to discuss the proposed FY 2015 budget and fare changes. We recently conducted an extensive public outreach effort for the budget. Thousands of people gave us feedback, and on behalf of the committee, I'd like to thank all who participated in our efforts, whether you came to the hearing or submitted your comments via our website. Those were all very important to us, and we look forward to the staff's presentation summarizing those comments. We'll also include a discussion about the Title VI analysis of the proposed fare change considerations. In addition, Deputy CFO Blair Fishburne will also walk us through the budget impacts of post-employment benefits, health care and pensions, as well as review strategies to achieve long-term cost savings while providing stability for current and future retirees that will receive the benefit. And finally, we will hear quarterly progress reports on FY 2014 second quarter capital and operating budgets. Right now, I'll turn the floor over to Lynn Bowersox, our Assistant General Manager for Customer Service Communication and Marketing, to begin this budget discussion. I'd also like to add there are three parts to this budget discussion, so I'll stop the presentation at the end of each of the those subsections, and then we'll have a discussion about that. So I'll turn it over to Lynn.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this morning, as the chairman said, we're going to talk about just a quick refresh on the public docket, the proposal that we put before our riders and our stakeholders. I'll give you a summary, a preliminary summary of the input that we got through the various channels. And then my colleague, Mr. Schofield, is going to talk in the second piece about Metro Access Fare Policy and the Title VI equity analysis. And then the chairman's comments about next steps. So with that, just a quick overview of the proposal. The committee will recall that we had a Metro bus fare increase in our docket that took us from $1.60 to up to $1.85 under consideration for Smart Trip users. And for bus riders who pay with cash, their fare could increase potentially from $1.80 to as much as $2. A proposal to eliminate the cash surcharge altogether was also put before the public for consideration. On Metrorail, an increase between 3% and 4% was proposed, with the surcharge for riders using a paper fare card remaining at $1 per trip. The proposed fare changes with respect to Metro Access riders did not include a change in the fare calculation, which currently is 2 times the equivalent bus or rail fare for the same trip. As a result, the fare for Metro Access customers would increase in line with the other fare increases, but the maximum Metro Access fare would remain at $7 per trip. And then finally, we proposed a 25-cent increase for daily parking at all Metro-operated parking facilities and an additional 50-cent surcharge for facilities in Prince George's County to pay for parking improvements at those facilities. In order to solicit the broadest possible public input from the jurisdictions, we went well beyond the traditional public hearings that Metro has historically used to gather input. We had pop-up events, and street teams were deployed to encourage the public's participation. The street teams handed out informational brochures that we produced, while the pop-up events included not just the brochures, but also staff on-site who could answer questions about service, fare proposals, capital improvements, and other issues that were before the public. In fact, we had 9 pop-up events between January 8th and 24th. Approximately 28,000 brochures were distributed, and we intercepted folks who took 400 surveys on site. Street teams were fielded at 24 transit locations between January 6th and 31st, and we distributed approximately 54,000 brochures and collected another 1,000 surveys at those locations. We also posted legal notices in local newspapers, including The Post, Washington Hispanic, El Tiempo Latino, El Pregonero, and Express India. And we placed ads in The Express, El Tiempo Latino, Epic Times, Korea Times, and The Washington Informer. We aired radio spots on 6 local radio stations, including in both English and Spanish language stations, and the 15-second ads ran more than 350 times over a 6-week period on stations such as WTOP, which is talk radio, WMMJ Magic, which is R&B, and WLZL Zol, which is Spanish. We issued news releases multiple times to more than 9,000 subscribers, and we worked with reporters and columnists to get the word out about the hearings. We placed a notice on the homepage of WMATA.com, which gets nearly 1 million visitors per month, and we distributed the information through email outreach and community lists that include 3,000 government, civic, business, and community stakeholders. We also posted notices on board Metro rail cars and on board our buses and Metro access vehicles, as well as banners and posters in our stations and transit stop locations. So as a result of all of that outreach, we did have a much higher level of public participation than we have seen in the past on this subject. The public comment period this time lasted 6 weeks, and the public was able to participate in person at meetings by sending us letters, emails, or phone calls, and by completing the online survey. In the 6 public hearings we had, there were 2 in each jurisdiction, and the hearings were attended by 300 people, with 113 of those individuals providing public comment. At the final hearing, which was the best attended, we had 125 members of the public and 42 speakers at that hearing location. This year's online survey resulted in 6,575 responses. That's nearly twice the number that completed Metro's last budget survey 2 years ago, and it is among the highest responses we've had to an online survey, of course not coming close to the one about station names, but which is still our record setter, but a very high level of participation. The online survey, in order to make sure that we included certain communities, low-income minorities, folks who with limited English proficiency, including the online survey, we oversampled folks in stations, at bus stops, at community meetings, and then, of course, we took tablets so people could take the online survey on site at some of our public hearings in Greenbelt, Anacostia, and Arlington. As a result, 43% of our survey respondents are minorities, and 17% are in households with incomes of less than $35,000. They are also representative of our region. The jurisdictions are all well represented. 40% of the respondents were from the district. The second largest was Montgomery County, 13%, and then Prince George's, Arlington, and Fairfax, all 11%. Metro also solicited comments on the budget and fare proposal through an online forum called Mind Mixer, and during 7 meetings, which you've heard before because we used it to gather information and input about momentum. An online forum, in addition to the 7 meetings at community-based organizations, which included folks from our Office of Equal Opportunity and Employment, going out to talk to folks, again, limited English proficiency, low-income residents, recent immigrants, and senior citizen organizations. Mind Mixer had 4,412 page views and a total of 1,291 visitors, interestingly, two-thirds of whom had never participated in Mind Mixer before. So we're encouraging more participation there. 5 rounds of questions were posted between January 7th and February 11th, generating 765 total actions. The most frequent action was to vote on the poll question. So a number of themes emerged from all of this input, and I will try to give you a summary of the major categories into which most of the public comment, regardless of which channel it came to us from, into which category it fell. 72% of the commenters at the public hearings and through written testimony commented on fare changes, and their comments were in opposition to the fare increases. But the survey revealed that less than a quarter of riders would significantly change their riding habits as a result of the proposed fares. So we need to take both the written comments and the survey into consideration there. With respect to Metro Access, there was a large turnout of Metro Access riders at each hearing, all expressing opposition unanimously to the impact that fare changes would have to the cost of their service. And the third category of comment was around service concerns. Metrorail and Metrobus service concerns were expressed in written comment at public hearings, and 44% of all comments were related to service concerns. We also received written testimony from Destination DC in support of the convention pass that's proposed, and we received testimony from Montgomery County Chamber of Commerce at the Rockville hearing in favor of the Momentum Strategic Plan. So when you drill down a little bit into the public's view of the fare proposal, you find in the survey that when asked about the Metro bus fare change, 25% of survey respondents said that a fare increase going to $1.75 would negatively impact their ridership, and 30% said the $1.85 price point would result in them making fewer trips. When asked about Metrorail fares, 20% of respondents said they would significantly decrease travel on Metrorail if a 3% fare increase were to take effect. And the numbers were a little higher, as you can see, for a 4% fare increase, with 23% of respondents saying they would significantly decrease ridership. With respect to the communities who we are looking at very closely on the Title VI analysis, you will see that their numbers are different from the general population of riders and stakeholders. The charts on the slide, this one, show that the percentage of riders who said they would take fewer trips on Metro bus or significantly decrease their travel on Metro rail is a little higher as a result of the fare increases proposed. Particularly on bus, there is demonstrated price sensitivity. With respect to Metro Access fares and the fare calculator, our Access customers commented that the proposed fare increases for rail and bus service will have the greatest impact on them because they pay twice the comparable fare for rail or bus. They, in fact, suggested that we consider reducing the fare calculation multiplier from 2 times to 1.5 or 1.25 times. Also, they called for a reduction in the maximum fare, the cap on their per-trip charge, from $7 to $6.50. Input gathered at the public hearings and through written comments also included service concerns, as I mentioned, and I just wanted to give you a sampling of those concerns in terms of the major areas where we heard the feedback. Crowding on both Blue and Orange Line trains was a subject of concern from principally Virginia riders. Gentleman Patrick Bailey, a Blue Line rider at Franconia, said that it's sometimes very difficult to get onto a Blue Line train at Roslyn, and then even after that, you don't know when your next Blue Line train may be coming because there are more Orange Line trains, which can also be crowded. We also had comments in the district about 16th Street Corridor bus service, which is very popular. Kishan Puta, one of the advisory neighborhood commissioners for DuPont Circle, said that residents mind having to watch bus after bus pass them by because they're full and not knowing when they're going to be able to board one to get to work. And bus service concerns were also expressed in Ward 8, particularly on the A-line bus route, where Mr. Woodward indicated that on the A-line, which is what he uses, is there an active schedule, or are they able to come when they want? Because it seems like he can't count on the regular frequency that we advertise. With respect to priorities for funding, the online survey and MindMixer tools asked riders to rank which investments were most important to them as the board contemplates the FY15 operating and capital budgets. The survey queried respondents on three categories of investments, including investing in assets, delivering quality service, and caring for customers. What you can see clearly here is that under the category of investing in our assets, track and rail structure improvements were somewhat or very important, top two box, in other words, to nearly every respondent. It was more than 9 in 10, 96%. And escalator maintenance was somewhat or very important to 9 of 10 respondents. Under caring for our customers, improving announcements in the system and signage, and training employees in customer service rated about 8 out of 10 customers saying that that was most important to them, and or among the most important things we could do. And in the category of delivering quality service, customers identified the delivery of the new 7000 series rail cars and replacing 200 buses a year as being high priorities for them. They are very anxious to see new equipment. With respect to MindMixer, the funding and initiatives to increase capacity and efficiency were very high on the list. And I will say what emerged is that the number one priority for our customers who participated in that discussion was expanding the number of 8-car trains we can offer in the system. If I may, I'll pause here before Mr. Schofield starts and answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bowersox, for the comprehensive presentation. Are there any questions regarding the public input and comments that you've heard so far? No? Okay. Thank you. We'll move forward with Mr. Schofield's presentation.
Not to the substance, but to the memorandum that we received from the AAC about the accessibility for the hearings themselves. Each of those points was a serious suggestion, and I hope that we will have a timely response with necessary funding commitments if they're required to solve those concerns for the next round of hearings.
Thank you for bringing up that point. That's very important. Mr. Schofield.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you just heard from Ms. Bowersox, during the public hearings, a number of customers gave testimony to us regarding our fare policy for Metro Access, in particular, how the fares are calculated and the overall level of the affordability of the fares. So the information that we're going to present here is intended to provide some context for those issues as we head into the final discussions about the FY15 fares. So first, just some history on how we arrived at our current fare policy for Metro Access. For most of our history, except for a couple years at the very beginning, we had a flat fare for Access that was twice the bus fare. Our Metro Access ridership grew steadily throughout the late 90s and into the 2000s, and it peaked in 2009 with a 22% increase in ridership over the previous year. At that point, the paratransit the operating support for paratransit began to approach that for rail, and that led to some serious concerns about the sustainability of the program from a fiscal perspective. And as a result, the board agreed to a number of different policy changes that took effect at different points in fiscal 2011, of which changing the fare policy was only one of them. The first was that the service area was redefined to be only the ADA required three-quarters of a mile corridor around the existing fixed route services. That took effect in July of 2010. Approximately 20% of our customer base at that time was grandfathered in then to allow them to continue to travel beyond that corridor if they needed to. The second change was that we changed the fare policy to the current twice the comparable fixed route rail or bus trip. Comparable is defined as the fastest trip because it acknowledges our obligation under the ADA to keep the paratransit trip duration comparable to that of fixed route transit. And charging twice the comparable fixed route fare is the maximum permissible under the ADA. This latitude is given to transit agencies in light of the costs and the requirements of providing complementary paratransit service. We also established a maximum fare of $7, which was well below the $10 or so at the time that could have been charged based on twice the peak rail fare. And then we instituted some demand management techniques, conditional eligibility, travel training, and offering riders to ride for free on rail and bus as ways to manage the demand for metro access. Those policy changes worked, and the growth that we had had previously was substantially mitigated during the last, say, 2 or 3 years. However, we have seen ridership growth pick up again over the last year or so. Through the second quarter of this year, our ridership is up about 6% versus budget and about 7% versus where we were last year. The primary cause for this ridership growth is a growth in the pool of registrants, you know, people who have joined Metro Access. The pool is up about 12 to 13% year over year, and that's across all three jurisdictions. It's not concentrated in one place. This mirrors the broader national trends that we're seeing as far as disability and aging and all the things that drive paratransit demand. Second, over the last decade, our market share for those types of trips has increased from about 25% to about 40%, and it continues to grow as we see some trips being shifted over from human service agencies to Metro. And if we look in detail at our data, even over the last year, we've seen a lot of growth in dialysis as a popular destination for our riders. And finally, the fare calculator, as we've talked about before, has reduced the average fare paid for Metro Access riders by about 5%, and it's reduced the share of the riders who are paying the maximum fare, and so we think this is having sort of a modest effect on the side as well. We expect these underlying trends to continue. We're not just sitting back, though, kind of hoping that things are going to get better. The Access Services folks are now working on some partnerships with the jurisdictions and with the human services providers to move some of these trips over to other providers. I mentioned dialysis. We are working right now to develop a pilot program with DDOT and the DC Taxi Cab Commission to move some of those dialysis trips over to taxi cab. That should offer better service to those riders and should also save costs. So where we are with the FY15 fare proposal. As Ms. Powersox reminded you, there has not been a proposal for any structural change in the Metro Access fare policy, but if we have higher rail and bus fares, those will translate into higher Metro Access fares. The overall increase in the fare under the general manager's proposal from December would be about 5%, but this would not be distributed evenly across the ridership base. We are using September 2013 data for the Title VI equity analysis. I'm using that data here as well. And we see that the riders fall into a couple of distinct groups. At one end, we have those riders who are already paying the maximum fare. They would see no change. That's about a quarter of riders. At the other end, riders who are only paying a fare that is just twice the bus fare, they would see an increase of about 30 cents, twice the 15 cent increase proposed for bus. And then we have a group of riders in the middle, most of whom are paying a mixed rail and bus fare as far as the comparable trip, and their average increase would be about 40 cents. In general, under the general manager's proposal, we project a very sort of modest impact on ridership from a 5% average fare increase, less than 1% of existing ridership. But if we were to make a more substantial policy change in terms of how we calculate the Metro Access fares, then I think that could have a more substantial impact on ridership as well.
Why don't we stop
and at that
here.
Point, I'll pause.
Okay. Why don't we stop here, and I'll open up for questions. I think Mr. Giancola had a question.
Yeah, thank you for the report. One of the recommendations, or a series of recommendations by the AAC, is dealing with lowering the calculator from 2 to 1. Say 7.5 or lower, or 1.5 and lower. The other is to lower the cap. Do we have any sense of what the impact would be on the budget projections or the revenue projections with those changes?
Sure, yes. The way to think about this is what revenue would we lose from existing riders, and then what do we think the impact would be on inducing added demand and the added subsidy that would add. So it's sort of a two-part calculation. The easier one is changing the cap to $6.50. I think on net we would lose a couple hundred thousand dollars from existing riders who are currently paying $7 and would see their fare reduced to $6.50. In terms of inducing additional ridership, again, you're talking about a pool of riders who constitute about a quarter of the ridership. They would be seeing their fare drop from $7 to $6.50. I think that would induce a little bit of extra ridership, probably on the order of $500,000 to $1 million worth of subsidy that would be required. Again, this is assuming sort of the average $50 a trip calculation. So that on net, the net impact to subsidy would I think be on the order of $1 million to $1.5 million. So this is to go from $7 down to $6.50. I think that one is fairly straightforward. The other one, changing the multiplier, is a little more complicated. You are talking about potentially a larger change. The best basis at the moment that we have for estimating rider behavior from a big change is actually when we went from is our previous change from a couple years ago when we went from two times bus to our current structure. We had our financial planning consultant look at the data back in FY12, FY13 after the change had happened, and to try to decompose all the different changes that we were doing at that time and try to isolate what they thought the impact of actually changing the policy was. Their estimate was that the ridership drop that we saw specifically because of that fare policy change was about 10%. So we've been using that as just sort of a round number basis for understanding the potential shifts. So I'm sorry, Mr. Ginkel, you said 1.75 as an example. Yeah, whatever. We've looked at a couple different numbers, but using 1.75. I think the revenue impact, again, just on existing riders paying a lower fare would be about $1 million. And the impact of inducing additional riders would be another, say, $2 million, so that you're looking at a net subsidy impact. Compared, and again, it's also important to be clear, are we talking compared to the general manager's proposal or are we talking about compared to now? But the net compared to now would be an additional $3 million or so worth of subsidy. It's not linear. I think if you were to lower it from 2 to something close to 2, I don't think you would induce some extra demand, but not a lot. When you start going 1.5, things that are much, then I think the potential is there for a more non-linear growth in ridership.
Okay, Mr. Baldwin, then this one.
Can you put that in a matrix for us?
Of course.
Per the letter that we received from the Accessibility Advisory Committee on February 25th.
Yes.
Current fares, general manager's proposal, and the best you can, Mark, on the nonlinear nature.
Yep. And in fact, we can be prepared to discuss this with the JCC tomorrow morning.
Well, that'd be great. I had one follow-on question. It seems to me we're spending a lot of time on fares, but in your earlier presentation, you said that registrations have really gone up, or new entrants. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to how that trend line has developed, and what are we doing to make sure new registrants for Metro Access are, correct, or mm-hmm. or however it works, because I don't know how,
sure.
how you sign up for Metro Access and get vetted. So
sure,
that's where the growth.
Yes,
that's where a lot of the growth here is.
Exactly. Now, Hey, Christian. I'll talk a little bit, and then I'll let Christian talk a little bit more about the eligibility process. But as I said, we've seen the registry.
17%, you said?
Or 12 to 13%.
12 to 13%.
Now, new, okay. Total trips has not grown by that same amount. Total trips has only grown by 6 or 7%. So right. Part of it is that the new riders are not necessarily riding as frequently as the existing riders. We're also getting some folks who are taking advantage of the conditional eligibility, so they sign up, they're conditionally eligible, and then they get to ride the bus and the rail for free. So we serve over 1 million trips per year of Metro Access patrons riding the bus and the rail for free. So that's also, I think, part of what's going on. But as far as the specifics of the eligibility process, Christian, do you want to take that for a second?
Well, thank you, Mark, and I just comment that the change in the registrants is more profound. We were staying at around 27 or 28,000 registrants for several years, and then suddenly 5,000 more registrants appear on the rolls within the last 12 to 18 months. I attribute that to the shift in the market share, that when it goes from 25% to 40%, that's where it's coming from. People are signing up for Metro Access service because they are finding that it's becoming their option of last resort, because when other services are no longer offered, we are the one service for the disability community that provides specialized transportation regardless of trip purpose. So it's not just for medical, it's for any type of travel that a person with a disability would need. And it has been generally affordable considering the comparison of just trying to hail a cab or use other services that are commercially available. And so when you look at it from that sense, Metro Access is often an attractive option when there are so few others, and that situation is worsening as human service agencies struggle to fund their transportation component when they have health care components that have become much more costly to sustain. So what we have been doing, and we alluded to this in the presentation, is that we're trying to find ways to enable those human service agencies to continue to provide transportation with some help and partnership from us, because they are often better able to provide the service. They have additional expertise in working with the people's specific disabilities, and the cost is often significantly lower. And so we're exploring those partnerships with our partners across the all the jurisdictions.
So, Christian, thank you. So, do you think this trend? I mean, it's a big jump in number of registrants. What do you call them? Registered users or what?
Active registrants, yes.
Active, and then there's conditional ones, which is like a whole other pool, right?
Well, no, I'm speaking of all of them.
Oh, okay.
That jump is there are two kinds. When we assess eligibility, so the traditional definition of being eligible for paratransit is you cannot use bus or rail because of your disability. And in the past, before we had conditional eligibility at Metro, it was a pass-fail kind of test. So if you were eligible for Metro Access, you were presumed completely unable to use bus or rail. That concept is a little bit contradictory to the fact that we also allow unlimited travel on bus and rail for those same individuals. So when we established conditional eligibility in 2010, the difference now is that we have a data point in each customer's file that says there are conditions, maybe not all the time, but there are conditions where they can use bus and rail. And that documentation is going to be important in the years to come as we find more fixed route options for people. So right now, interestingly enough, since we started doing that, more than half of the people that we assess fall into that category. So if there was an assumption before that every Metro Access customer could never use bus and rail, that's proven to very much not be true. And the remaining customers are either fully eligible, which means that they really have very little likelihood that they would be able to use bus or rail at all, or they're temporarily eligible because of maybe they've had an injury or something that will resolve over a period of time. And in those cases, we provide a shorter period of eligibility for them.
Mrs. Hines, the subject.
Thank you, Mr. Acosta. So I've been thinking a lot about this, and we certainly heard from people at the hearings that this was of concern to them. And as we think about potential adjustments, what I have been thinking about, and perhaps it makes sense to some of my colleagues, is that we might look, if we're going to look at the multiplier question, we might ask ourselves the question of what adjustment in the multiplier would deliver to us the same kind of increase that the rail rider is experiencing, so somewhere between 3% and 4%. Can we adjust the multiplier to basically say Metro Access customers would have the same increase that everyone else had, rather than what happens when we do it the way we're doing it, they get kind of closer to twice the increase in fare. And you know, I look at those numbers up there, and while I appreciate that the $7 may feel like a lot to people, I think when you look at the percent of the cost of the trip that those folks are paying, and the fact that there's no change proposed, I'd much rather spend my dollars on that multiplier if we can find something that is affordable. Tom and others asked about a matrix. There's some other dollar amounts that we're going to need to understand the impact on subsidy, including if we were to keep the cash surcharge, what does that mean on rail, if we were to keep the cash surcharge on, the paper card charge on rail, as we try to work our way through to what the right thing is. But I would rather see us find a philosophical way to adjust this than to just pick a number, a way that is defensible as we move forward, and that could set us at least to a place where we have a rationale that we can all articulate. The last conversation that's been going on about the our market share, for lack of a better term, although that usually you want to see your market share increasing, so it's a little difficult. And I appreciate all the outreach work that Metro staff has already done on this, but I do think we need to take this conversation probably into COG and very explicitly frame it up. Moving folks who have disabilities is not just a Metro issue. It's a regional issue. It's about complying with the law. It's about everybody. And while we sit here and kind of make these trade-offs, in fact, it's how do we think about the region helping these folks have a quality of life. And so it's really not, I mean, we're delivering the service, but we need to have the bigger conversation as governments make different choices. And we do have models. I mean, DC's trying to do with taxi cabs. Arlington's got an example of its own service, which has a different payment structure, which has been proven to be very successful for us and more affordable. I just think we need to take this into a bigger regional conversation that's not just about the cost of transit, but it's about how the jurisdictions are supporting these folks having the quality of life that we think they should. So that would be sort of a moving on. Obviously, we're not going to do that between now and when we adopt the budget, but I think we need to figure out how to structure that conversation.
Thank you. Mrs. Hutchins?
And then Mr. Downs, Ms. Hampshire-Cowan, and then Mr. Downey.
Thank you, and thank you for the presentation. And following along on first on Ms. Hines' last comment, that I think this is a larger issue. I think Mr. Kenton, everyone's been part of this discussion for a very long time. And COG's Access for All is a very active group. I think, along with other things that we've been wanting to do in terms of how do we bring revenue in order to bring equity into the system, is very important. And I think that's at a federal level, and it will only solve that problem. I think the localities are all facing the same when it comes to the trends. And really, it's a good news piece, but it is an unfortunate cost on the other end that makes our juggle that we have every day a little bit harder. We really want to be able to look at a transit system that everybody sees its same and equitable value, and I think about the calculator as that, probably, if that can be found, because it doesn't matter whether or not you're taking any mode. If your cost of that increase and you can't afford it, you're still disparately affected by it. One piece of data that I think we should want to add in it is what are the numbers of trips that we see on average of just the metro access, that is, not those that would be taking fixed system, but just the metro access on average per day and month. Because I think there, it also, I hope, gives us a picture of what this service means to people and what they can or cannot do. And that may be helpful. I know I'd love to see what that looks like. And I think we've seen it before.
If I may ask, you're asking, Mrs. Hudgens, for kind of a trending of that,
yes,
of kind of the average weekday ridership and monthly. I think that's a very important point. As of last week, we've seen the ridership on Metro Access peaking higher than it has been for the last 3 or 4 years. So, and that's even with the weather conditions that we have had. So when we had done an actuarial analysis on the ridership, and we update this each year, we knew that there was going to be some reduction as we promoted travel training and kind of made the eligibility process a little bit more robust and helping people to learn about fixed route options. But there was an inevitable return of growth in the ridership because of demographics and some of the other factors we've mentioned, like the shifting market share. And as Mark indicated, with the 6% higher ridership than we expected, where it's showing up is in that peak weekday ridership, that it's heading back toward 8,000 trips. That's quite a bit.
Thank you. Mr. Downs?
Thank you. Back to the dilemma that the authority faced about the acceleration in the cost of subsidy on access. First, the authority limited its service to the FDA mandate, not universal access. We don't have that as an option anymore. Second, we adopted, however uneasily, price as a control over demand. We may be reaching the limits of pricing as a strategy to control demand. I've not heard anything that shows any specifics about what is driving this new spike. There are assumptions about jurisdictions pushing people off of Medicaid-supported transportation services onto access because it's easier and cheaper. It's not cheaper, and it's sure not easier for us. But that's a set of assumptions. I don't know what's happening with the roles of the jurisdiction, what the enrollment roles of the jurisdiction entities look like. And if it shows significant decreases, then it's a sign of an ongoing problem. This problem can grow without a lot of real hard information, can grow to the size of a problem that we had before. There is no analysis of the impact of demographics, the bleeding edge of the baby boomer population is approaching 70. We have no idea whether or not this part of this is being driven by demographics. The district's in the process of trying to launch soon a dialysis transport program because it's in the district's best interest and we think it's more cost effective. Arlington has a service that tries to absorb people in this. I don't know if those are options going forward, but we have no plan about how to assess that and the impacts going forward. I'm reluctant to blindly assume that because we've adopted price as a control, that we can, without a lot of forethought, understand price elasticity in this environment. And I don't believe we have a clue ultimately about price elasticity. We have some swags about the impact that price has on demand in this. if we're serious about my favorite hobby horse, about bus stop accessibility, and we're trying to get more people comfortable with using mainline service, we've got to get a lot more serious about bus stop accessibility. It just, it's miserable. The last thing that I would comment on is that roughly a third of the people who appeared in the hearings that I attended mentioned the lack of predictability about the system, what the system generates as information about pricing. I know the AAC loved the ability to get information about pricing. What they're apparently not as happy about, and I can't blame them, is having on the same day, from the same point to the same point, two different prices. I know it varies by time of day. Different days, different prices. The mechanism of pricing is independent of the price itself, but the primary criteria that I heard was make it predictable. Make it predictable so that I can plan trips around a certain time frame. If I want to save money and it's not going to be $7, it's going to be $3.50, I'll do it. I'll try and make a different choice. But what I've heard is they can't plan based on the predictability of the system. It's just too complex. So I want to put the predictability on the table as part of a solution for what we're struggling with. I'm not sure we actually have enough data to make a wise decision about pricing without understanding its impact on demand and the overall pressure on the subsidy going forward. It's a very uncomfortable place to be in.
Ms. Hampshire Cowan?
Yeah, Mr. Downs has raised the issue I wanted to inquire about. I found an alarming number of our clients concerned about that issue throughout the hearing process, and in interacting with them post the hearing, it is an issue that we really got to figure out.
Mr. Downing?
Yeah, two questions. One, I'm following up on Downs, and I heard the same thing at the hearing about the unpredictability. My recollection of the lengthy work we took on with the AAC was the intent of making a fare calculator the basis for intelligent shopping. And I don't know that we really have achieved that purpose at this point. And the other is there any evidence that our new contractor and the level of service that contractor is providing is contributing to the growth in ridership? So two questions.
Both excellent questions. I'd like to start with the second one first. It has been our experience that when the contractors do a good job and there's a general higher confidence in the reliability of the service, that it becomes an even more attractive option and more people use it. So I would say yes, I think that that's true. You know, that is something that we've worked on for many years since I've been here, is trying to win back that confidence in the reliability of the service. And the new business model is meant to augment that further. So I do think that public confidence in Metro Access as a reliable transit option has contributed to the increase in ridership. On the predictability issue, you know, I've certainly heard the same feedback myself. I meet with the AAC several times a month, so we certainly have been aware of this long before the hearings. It is the same problem of having a distance-based fare on the rail. It's not a flat fare. The only difference is that if you're a paratransit customer, you can have a conversation before you leave your home with a reservations agent about your trip and about what the fare is going to be. The fare calculator allows you to tell the agent when you'd like to travel, and it gives you the lowest fare available under our current policy within a 30-minute interval around the time that you requested. The issue prior to the fare calculator was that you would not be able to get that result unless you asked for 30 different times. Now you can give one time and be assured that you will get the lowest available fare within that 30 minutes around the time you asked for, without having to make separate inquiries. But in terms of whether a person is able to shop for the fare, you know, I think that's a bit relative. If you ask for a fare at 9 o'clock and the fare that they give you is $7, and they say within that time frame, again, recognizing that that's morning peak service, that the rail system is often going to be the fastest option to get you where you're going, that's not an uncommon result. But you could ask for a different time. The agents work with the customers and allow them to ask for other times to see whether or not they might be able to get a more favorable result. Probably the aspect that's been, I guess, the most difficult for us to work with customers on is the notion of, well, assuming you want me to trust the system, if I do make a similar trip, and I get a different fare. Now I don't have confidence that the calculation is working properly. And again, as we've shared this information separately, changes to the fare tables themselves, track work, other things, changes to bus routes regionally, anything that changes the fixed route fare system will have an impact on the fare that's charged to the Metro Access customer. And all of those factors are not going to be easily understood or transparent to the customer. What I can tell you is that we have checked the system technically, and it is working as it was designed to do. Unfortunately, I just don't think, as we've heard, that the design has fully met the expectations of everyone.
Just one follow-up on that. I've never used the calculator. I use airline booking all the time, and one of the options you have on those systems is, when could I travel to get the cheapest fare? In addition to, if I want to go at a particular time, if I'm willing to fly Spirit Airlines, I could get a low fare. But I don't think we offer that option, do we? When could I go and get a cheap fare?
Well, and that's true. It does not say, if you want for the entire day of travel, you know, what's the optimal time of day for you to get the fare you want. And, you know, that's a feature that we could explore, but the current system doesn't have it.
Any other questions? Ms. Porter?
I wanted to follow up a little bit on Mr. Down's comment about the relationship between the increase in ridership and fares. I think he correctly pointed out that we really don't know everything about the dynamics of that relationship. And I think that's very important, because if our desire is to provide good service but not have it be inordinately expensive, knowing why it's going up is critical to knowing what we can do to ameliorate it in a way that doesn't cut service to customers. For example, Montgomery County is running a pilot project, which I know you know about, which Metro provides funding to a social service agency that provides transportation that is lower cost than Metro Access, but more responsive to the needs of a very specific ridership than we can provide. And there may be other solutions like that out there that we're not going to be able to get to unless we know more about that relationship. And, I mean, you talked about elasticities and things like that. I think we've got to get even deeper into it than that before we really know what that relationship looks like. And if we don't know what that relationship looks like exactly, we're not going to have a good sense of what we can do to maintain service to our customers while at the same time doing things that keep the cost from going beyond what we can afford. I mean, I think there are ways to do that. What we're exploring in Montgomery County is maybe one of them, but we're not going to know what those options are unless we know more about what that relationship looks like.
Well, I absolutely agree, and I'd like to just add that to Mr. Downs's comment that when we said the market share went up to 40%, the source of that data was canvassing the human service agencies in the region and doing a before and after of how many trips they were carrying. So we can actually show that those agencies are transporting far fewer people than they were before. We know which agencies they are. That's one of the reasons why we've started to move off of, you know, just simply looking at the solutions we've been working on, like the travel training and certainly the policies that are already in place that might have some impact on elasticity, to working on these partnerships. We're talking about it in the context of momentum and the regional transportation plan to look ahead to 2025 and beyond, because conceivably there could be another million trips on Metro Access if we were to push out well into the future. And given how much the service costs, you know, that would be a drag on our ability to do you know, the other improvements that are planned elsewhere in our transit network. So that's very important that we keep our eyes on this. And I do agree that COG is the right venue. They do have a Human Services Transportation Coordination Task Force, and it's our intention to take the data that we've been providing you on the market share and bring the stakeholders together in that environment to really talk about this as a regional issue. Because I agree, you know, we've been careful not to make too many definitive statements about elasticity, because it really has been a short time frame that we've been making these changes. And, you know, I agree with Mr. Downs. I don't know that we're ready to make any conclusive comments about the elasticity, but we certainly can be very definite about the movement of trips onto our service.
Ms. Hines' suggestion about the COG, in particular TPB, is the forum to have this, and maybe literally a forum on mobility in this for this segment of our population in the region going forward. We've had a lot of conversations about 2025 and momentum, but we have not had a kind of parallel conversation about this set of services, given an aging population and the changing participation among governments in the region. And it seems like an ideal forum for the region to convene and talk about.
Mr. Acosta.
Yes, and then one more question.
I would suggest, to follow up on that, that perhaps a letter from our board to TPB requesting that they, or wherever we decide in COG we should go, requesting that they convene this conversation might be a way to not have this linger as an unscheduled topic of conversation.
That's a very good suggestion. I think this after a question.
We know there are a lot of variables in the calculation, but what I heard from a lot of clients, and Tom raised this issue too, is that they have standing appointments and consistent appointments, and they get a different fare, same day, same time, you know, same day. So is there a possibility that within our system, our clients are able to book all of their trips? You know, if they have a Tuesday, Thursday, 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock to the same place, most of them are medical appointments. It seems to me we should be able to accommodate that and get a consistency in the fare.
Well, I agree, and I understand the concern. What we have is subscription service for customers who know that they're going to make a similar trip on a regular basis. We can put a standing order into the system so that the customer doesn't have to make a unique reservation every time they want to travel. It can stay in the system. They don't have to make any more phone calls to us. So that was meant to be the main convenience from it. When we were under the flat fare system, then the fare also didn't vary. But what happens now is that the reservation is still in the system. But each week when the standing orders are loaded into our scheduling template, it does calculate the fares anew based on where the fare tables are presently, because of, again, as I mentioned before, some of the fixed route fares will have changed. So in order for those fares to always match twice the fixed route comparable, we have to have more of a current update on what the fare is. And, you know, I would just add one more comment, that the reason why we did this is because that calculation ensures that Metro is never overcharging a fare. Sometimes what can happen is the fare changes would result in the customer paying less. So if we left the same amount in the system and then something had changed, then we might be charging them more than twice the fixed route equivalent, and then we have an ADA problem. So that's why we're so careful to make sure that each fare that is calculated matches the current set of circumstances.
Hudgens.
I just wanted to reinforce the conversation regarding the COG involvement, because I think we need to acknowledge that the COG chair, TPB, is the Access Fellow chair, and that COG, and I would say Mr. Kent, really have cut their teeth on the fact that this is of an important service, and with Metro at the table. So I think what should be is that everybody is in the room together so that we can all understand where we're going with it, because I think it has been the driver from the COG side with Metro that has helped us get to this point. And if there is more that we should be doing, we do it in a forum that allows all of the partners to be in the room together. And that means our clients as well, because it is a very engaged process at the TPB as well as it is here. And those clients are engaged from that level as well as the staff and the providers there. So it is a larger piece, but it does require, I think, us more engaged so that we're all comfortable as to the solutions that we see and how we look to that long-term future, because it is, I fear that so much of that is beyond our predictability, because it is a larger issue of a changing demographic of the disability community.
Thank you. Mary Ulls, and this will be the last question we need to make.
Well, thank you, and I really didn't intend to chime in on this, but it's been a very fruitful discussion, and I guess maybe I've been around here too long on the board, because it seems like you know, just about every year, budget time, we go through this conversation, we have this dialogue, and the reality of it all is that, you know, we're always looking for new ideas, suggestions, and everything, how to address this, and I certainly do like, and the fact that it is being, and has been discussed by COG via TPB and everything else, and even local jurisdictions, each municipal, a lot of our own municipal governments and our compact members are looking to do, if they don't already have in existence, their own paratransit programs, they're looking to, you know, complement something to the existing WMATA Metro Access. But I guess maybe what, you know, we ought to look at, and I'm sure we have, is look at best practices for other cities and towns that have something similar. And maybe they don't, because we're the best that's out there. And everybody else is looking at what we do and how we do it. But it is, you know, I don't have any answers to it, but it's frustrating, because, for 13 years I've sat here and we've always had this conversation, the dialogue, but yet we keep moving on, and I don't know what the answers are, but and maybe there aren't any real concrete answers. Maybe it is what it is, and we just have to, you know, accept that and coexist.
Thank you. Let's move on to Title VI. Mr. Schofield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to move through this one. I think the conclusions on this one are a little bit more direct. The FY15 docket allows for the board to choose from a range of different fare changes for each mode. The presentation here is intended to provide a preliminary look at some of the different increased combinations that might be considered, and is intended to provide some guidance for the board as it works toward the final adoption of the FY15 fare changes. I want to say thank you also to our planning group and our civil rights group for their support in doing this. So the board approved policy on disparate impact and disproportionate burden, or DIDB, states that the system-wide difference between the average fare increase for minority and low-income riders as compared to non-minority and non-low-income riders shouldn't be greater than 5 percentage points. And our rider demographics are the key to doing the equity analysis. Based on our recent passenger surveys and on the 2010 census data, Metro Bus has a higher level of minority ridership than Metro Rail, 76% versus 43%. And Bus also has a greater share of low-income riders, 43% versus 11%. So fare change combinations that are weighted more heavily against Bus have a higher risk of not passing the DIDB test. So the key modeling assumptions for doing the test. As I mentioned earlier, we are using September 2013 data to do the equity analysis, our usual representative months, so as not to get too caught up in the weather or the holidays or visitors or things like that, are May and October. We chose not to use October this time around because of the government shutdown, so we decided to use September. That's still a pretty good month. Two practical points, then, as you all are making your considerations. One, two of our smaller proposals on the docket, the convention pass and the Redskins parking at Largo and Morgan Boulevard, those are not included in the Title VI calculation. We simply don't have the data necessary to know how the minority and low-income populations are using or would use those two products, so you can make your decisions about those two proposals without having to worry about Title VI. More importantly, though, the Title VI work that we do is system-wide. We're looking at the system-wide impact on those low-income and minority populations. So any proposed changes to metro access and to parking, those are included in the analysis. The potential proposal to get rid of the cash surcharge on bus, that's included in the analysis. But overall, those changes are relatively small compared to the base rail and bus fare changes that we're considering, which are impacting hundreds of millions of trips per year. Yeah, sure.
The equity analysis, et cetera, is system-wide. Is it possible to know what it is by jurisdiction?
We have it by mode. I have that in the appendix right now. We do not have it broken out at the moment in this presentation by jurisdiction. I do not think it is available by jurisdiction, not easily. I think we could do it, but I don't want to commit to that.
Can you do it at a macro level? The region, and then you apply.
Mean? What would by jurisdiction mean? Trip exclusively in a jurisdiction?
No, where minorities live by jurisdiction.
They're measuring trips.
Okay. I know. What I'm trying to get to is another way of figuring what the impact is on the District of Columbia.
I understand.
Okay. By applying the number of minority individuals by jurisdiction to the macro trip data. Is that possible?
No. No. Jim, do you want to?
Hey, we're getting a little off.
Sorry, sorry I asked the question. I apologize for.
Let me.
I'm sorry.
Our obligation is to review it against the standards that we have adopted. I understand there may be interest in understanding the other impacts by jurisdiction, but I think for the purpose of our final decision, we have, in fact, adopted a set of policies that guide our analysis. So I just want to make that clear.
Yes, very true. And also, the FTA requirement is that we look at by total system, not by jurisdiction. That's part of that. Okay.
Thank you, Jim. So as I was saying, while the board has important decisions to make about each of the, about metro access, about parking, and about the cash surcharge, what I would call the really big decisions can be boiled down into sort of a two-by-two decision matrix, and that's what we have here. So the big questions are, is the base bus fare going to be $1.75 or $1.85? And is the rail increase going to be 3% or 4%? Those may not sound like big differences, but as far as the Title VI implications, they are actually fairly important. So the first proposal here in green is what the general manager proposed in December, $1.75 on bus and 3% on rail. That combination passes the Title VI test fairly easily. Minorities on average would see a average increase in their fares that is 1.4 percentage points higher than non-minorities, and low-income riders would see an average fare increase that's 2.6 percentage points higher. And again, both of those are well below the board-approved threshold of 5 percentage points. So the next one in the lower right corner is what we called in the board memo from just a couple weeks ago the full docket. This assumes that we adopt the maximum fare increases across all the different options that we have in the docket. We have this one colored yellow because it does pass the equity test, but it almost fails. It has a 2.9 percentage point difference for minority populations and a 4.7 point difference for low-income populations. So you're coming close to failing on the low-income test. So then the third one, which we called the high-impact scenario, because it was expected to sort of exacerbate the Title VI implications. This has the $1.85 bus fare, but only the 3% rail fare. And we have it red because it fails. If we go with the higher bus increase and the lower rail increase, we will not pass the equity test for low-income populations. And then just for completeness, although we did not include this in the board memo, we did run the numbers for the upper right corner. If we were to go with the lower bus increase of $1.75 and then the higher rail increase of 4%, as you would expect, given the dynamics, since in this one you've compressed the difference between the rail and the bus increase, that one passes with even a little bit less of an impact than the general manager's proposal. Obviously, the board has a number of different dimensions that it has to consider when it's looking at the fare increases as far as the ridership impacts and the fiscal impacts, but hopefully this gives you a broad sense of where we are likely to either have concerns or not have concerns, given what the final board direction is as far as fares. So our next tasks in this area are to complete the staff report with all the information that Mrs. Bowersox gave you earlier. Once we get the final direction from the board about where it looks like we're headed as far as fares, to do the final equity analysis, and then for us in the budget office, again, given that direction from the board, to determine what the final impacts are for revenue and subsidy. Sure. Oh, yeah, of course. Again, this just recaps where we are with the calendar. We had the proposal and the authorization for the public hearings in December. We had all the outreach in January and February. So here we are at the very end of February. We are still looking in March towards the adoption of the operating budget and then the fare proposal. As you know, we are now looking at April for the adoption of the capital budget. And then assuming that the fare changes are adopted, we'd be looking at on or about July 1st, beginning of the fiscal year, for the implementation of the fare changes.
Thank you, Mr. Schofield. Are there any questions about the Title VI analysis?
Yeah, two questions.
Yep.
One process, one substance. In terms of process, we will have to focus in on a particular proposal we will have to focus in on a particular proposal in order to get a final Title VI analysis. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Although we might ask for more than one to be looked at, we have to actually have a solid analysis of the one that's adopted.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And the second, this is just, could you put the slide back with the four, mm-hmm. the matrix? I'm just trying to get my head around the math here.
Sure.
As to why the impacts in the right-hand column are less than the comparable.
We have, so.
And I guess, see if I understand it. It is because a higher rail increase actually reduces the disparity against a fixed amount of bus increase.
That's exactly right.
Right. So if we really soaked the rail rider, we would really reduce the disparity. But it's not a function of a lower bus increase. It's a function of the higher rail increase.
If you were to go the other direction and only increase rail fares 2%, you would be heading towards just problems again. So.
Right. Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Mr. Downs?
It goes without saying that we shouldn't be proposing to the public fare increases that can't pass a Title VI. That's useless. It's confusing for the public. It raises the question about the timing process for analysis. I know that this is the first year that we've lived under the new Title VI FTA regulations. I would suggest strongly, and even though we only do this fair process every 2 years, that we think hard about the timing and the process of bringing fare increase recommendations to the board, what goes into that analysis before that recommendation comes to the board at a finance committee meeting for a recommendation about fares that will be taken to public hearing. the involvement of the jurisdictions, how that plays out so that we don't have this kind of, at the end, mixed messages about how much flexibility the board ought to have and not have in the fare increase process, with an assumption that a simpler fare proposal is better than a very complex one, which confuses the public and sends potential mixed messages and gets us to a fare increase proposal that can't pass Title VI. This process needs a lot of re-engineering and thinking, and I would hope that the staff could bring back at some point to the Finance Committee a revised process that the board could look at and review and kibitz about the setting the fare proposals in a timely fashion, including Title VI preliminary analysis, before we get to a public hearing authorization.
Thank you. Any other questions? Ms. Porter?
I realize that in this analysis you're looking at the system as a whole, but and you said that the cash options didn't make a big difference in the system as a whole, cash on bus, and I'm sure that's true. But in terms of the board looking at those options, it would be useful to know what the impact of that is. Do you have data looking, I mean, do you actually collect data on the demographic characteristics of people who use cash versus people who do not?
Yes.
Because that would be a useful thing to have, I think, in terms of the board looking at the cash.
Sure. We're keeping this presentation at a fairly high level, just
right.
Given that. But we have that data. We could certainly share it.
That would be helpful.
You have, just as an example. Sorry. Well, just to use a slightly different example, the proposal for the Prince George's County surcharge on parking does not have a huge impact on the overall right. bottom line number, but it has a noticeable impact on minority parkers. Given that it's in Prince George's County, we have the level of detail to do that sort of a calculation. We have the data to do the cash surcharge, absolutely. So we can find a way to.
And I'm assuming the impact would look a lot like the bus increase.
Oh, just just to provide some context, right now cash accounts for only about 5% or 6% of trips on bus. So having that or not having that surcharge, as far as the bottom line, is only going to move it a tenth of a percentage point, something
right.
like that.
But I mean, but on the people, the demographics of the people who use cash on the buses, what does that look like compared to overall bus riders or overall system riders? That's what I'm getting at.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I don't have that handy at the moment. We can absolutely provide that.
Right.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. Well, I don't have the exact number, but low-income riders are disproportionately represented among those who currently pay the cash surcharge. Sorry, it took me a while to get to that.
But again, if I understand our legal obligation under Title VI, it is at the total system, total ridership.
Yes.
It may be useful to look at particular groups, but we're not obligated to assure that every group within the system is within the 5%.
No.
But individual board members may be concerned if there is a proposal that has a heavily disproportionate effect on low-income riders. Yeah.
That's a policy call, not a legal requirement.
Other questions? Okay, if not, at our March 13th meeting, we will be having a deliberation about the operating budget. I would ask that if there are any other fare package scenarios that you would, I mean, we have four right now, that you want to discuss, that we know that sooner than later. In fact, if you would just submit those to me, tomorrow, that would be helpful. Also, if there are any questions, while we're speaking, I'm going to focus mostly on the fare package. There are other items that you may want to discuss. I know that you have submitted questions that we've been going back and forth in terms of answering those questions that you might have about other aspects of the budget. But if you believe there are other areas that you would like to put forward for discussion, please let me know, and we'll make time for that at our next meeting. Mr. Goldman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned that we would be considering the operating budget in March, and I wanted to raise whether this is the appropriate time to have a conversation whether that should be the right scheduling of events or whether you want to save that till the end of your meeting. I would like to have a discussion and perhaps a proposal as to changing the process as you've just stated.
We might as well have this discussion now if you have a proposal to make. Go ahead.
Do I have to make a motion, or are we just having a discussion?
Well, why don't you raise your questions and your general concerns about
this? I guess I have two kinds of concerns. First, in terms of scheduling, I'm new to this, and sure. It just strikes me that if we're going to get a report on the fair analysis, we might want to get that report and have time to read it and think about it rather than having to vote on an operating budget the same day. So I would be proposing that we have just a receipt and consideration of a report in March and an actual vote on an operating budget in April. The second thing I want to raise is that it seems to me that there's been a lot of events in water over the dam or under the dam since we originally got a proposal and a forecast of an operating budget for FY15, and it might be appropriate to ask staff for some revision or an update of the operating budget that would take into account, you know, things like, you know, the ending of the travel benefits, reduction of the travel benefits at the end of the year, what's now expected to be a more lengthier delay than originally anticipated in the startup and the gear up of the Silver Line service, which logically may have an effect on revenue for the full year of FY15. And just, I assume we now have 3 or 4 months more information and data on traffic and revenue that would be useful to put into a revised forecast. So those are the two kinds of issues that I would want to raise.
Actually, I'd like to ask, well, part of what you've raised is actually an issue about staff being able to produce the reports and the analysis that you would like to see before our next committee meeting. So I do need to ask the general manager or the deputy general manager for a response to that, whether they could provide that in a timely manner before the March 13th meeting.
As you've heard this morning, we've laid out Title VI analysis now for 4 scenarios on fare increases. We, as was mentioned, we cannot give you an analysis until, from a policy viewpoint, you've decided which scenario you want to do, or some variation. It doesn't have to be the scenario. Until we get that indication, it doesn't have to be firm, but until we get that indication, we can't give you the final Title VI report. Otherwise, we will come back here a couple weeks from now, but basically the same presentation on 4 different scenarios, unless there's another one that comes up. And we have to have a decision from the board at some point as to which one you want to go with. So that controls the timing of that. I'll let Carol talk to the other.
And what the board would should do today is have the discussion with respect to where fares, the alternative fare proposal or the primary fare proposal that you'd like. We've heard some of this today, which gives us some guidance. We've heard a little bit on the Metro Access, which we'll go back and look at the factors to try to figure out what the impact is. We can do that analysis and then come back in the March meeting, the March FA meeting, which I think is the 13th. And provide that in total for you. We can also provide you the understanding where the Silver Line is. We do understand the impact of 15. We understand the transit benefits. I will tell you that the revenue projections that we have probably will not be changed at all. We may be tinkering around the edges of a bit, but it'll be primarily what you've seen in the general manager's proposal. But we would be prepared to provide all of the, based upon this discussion, we would be prepared in March 13th to provide you what that looks like. And then at that point, you can make that decision whether or not we would proceed or not, or in the March board meeting to adopt a budget, or if there's something else that needed to be reviewed, it could be then pushed out to April. But that's the scenario. What I've heard today wasn't really the request of information that you wanted is not complicated. We'd be poised to do that, and we would be prepared to provide it on March 13th.
Let me, I think it's very important for us to move forward with a discussion on March 13th. Regardless of whether all the information is available or not, we still need to have a discussion to winnow down at least to a couple of options, if not one option, that we feel we can move forward with. There may be other questions that may arise at that meeting that the staff may not be able to answer, or we may not be able to answer, that may require a little more time. It does not necessarily obligate us to vote on it at that meeting, or the board as a the full board to vote it at the subsequent March meeting, but I do think we need to continue this discussion so we can move this forward, because there are also implementation issues in terms of moving forward with a final fare package as well as the final Title VI analysis. So my suggestion is that we stick to the schedule. If people are not comfortable at that point in terms of winning down to a final option, we do have a little wiggle room, but I think it's important for us to have a full discussion. And it's going to be structured more as a work session, so we'll try to get everything off out on the table. I think you have scheduled the afternoon, back to March 13th, to have this discussion. So that's my preference. I don't think delaying it by a month and not discussing it is not going to do us any good. I think we really need to have a discussion to kind of see where it goes. And there are no guarantees, obviously, but we need to continue this discussion with the best information we have available at that time.
So just to be clear on the timetable, we will get a revised FY15 operating budget and revenue forecast sometime before the March 13th meeting?
You'll get the materials that we're going to present at the March 13th meeting. You'll get those materials, and if they veer from the general manager's recommendation, we will provide that in those materials. Yes, that's correct. But you will not be getting another budget book, if you will. The base budget book that was provided, the preliminary, is what you have, and we'll work off of that based upon what the changes are going to be.
But you're going to, we'll get an actual document that shows what your revised or updated revenue forecast is prior to March 13th.
Yes, you will. Yes,
as a document, not a talk through.
No, it'll be a whole document. What I've heard from Ms. Hines and Mr. Acosta was there's been a lot of questions that have been generated, probably over 100 that we've answered. We provided that to you over time. Some of the questions have come from the JCC. What we'd probably do is put that package together again and put it on in the package, so you have a consolidated package of what all the Q&As have been over the last several few months, and then what the new update is going to be. So we'll provide that as one.
And so that will include, you mentioned the JCC, because I guess there's a list of about 65 JCC questions.
There are.
And so we'll get answers to that as well.
Yes.
In the submission prior to March 13th.
Prior to March 13th. So you'll have a week, as we do typical mail-outs, it'll be mailed out the Friday before the Thursday meeting, and you'll have a week to review that. Plus, I believe we'll be, do we have another JCC meeting? We have another JCC meeting tomorrow, so the discussion that we've had here, we'll have another discussion with the JCC to make sure that we tie down any loose ends.
Right. What I'm trying to do is get just a timeline, because to the extent that we'd like input from the JCC, to educate us prior to the March 13th meeting. I'm trying to understand, when will the JCC get the written answers so that they can review and massage their stuff and give to the Maryland and Virginia and D.C. members in time for the March 13th meeting?
If I'm not mistaken, I think a majority of the answers have been provided to the JCC. Is that correct?
Sorry.
Ooh. Whoa.
We had a budget work session with the JCC a week or two ago. We went over the answers to a number of those questions verbally. We have not yet provided them the specific written answers. We had a few that hadn't been done yet. We probably need another day or two to finalize those, and then we can provide them to the JCC.
So they'll get written answers by the end of this week to the 65 questions? Is that the
by tomorrow?
That's what I'm asking. Yes, you're saying
at the beginning, maybe at the very beginning of next week.
Okay. beginning of next week, they will get their answers to the 65 written
questions. Well, some just to
I'm
be,
just trying to understand, what your time
we have so, most of the questions, absolutely, yes. The operating budget, the capital budget, the fares, the subsidy, all that. We have deferred a few of the questions that are more operational in nature to be handled at a separate JCC meeting.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, could I just ask if you provide written answers to the JCC, would you circulate it to the board?
Absolutely.
Mr. Costa,
Ms. Hart.
If I could just circle back to this is actually a really important conversation. One of the issues I think that the board and the public need to understand, and that's why I'm raising it here, is given the assumptions that you built into your budget, both on revenues and on expenditures, which, if any of those, have shifted. And so I would like to request that we start out on the 13th with that, so that we don't focus on how we're filling whatever gap, but that we understand what how the landscape has changed or not changed since you presented your budget. And then we can move into the, okay, now we know, you know, we've asked our questions, we're comfortable, and then we can move into that, how do we bring the money to the table question. But we really need to start out with that larger picture of how do the things that Michael mentioned and other things that we might not be thinking about right now, how have they changed the landscape and the underlying assumptions. So I think it'd be really helpful if you would go through those, set that presentation up, that you go through those things with us as the start.
Thank you for the suggestion. Any other questions? Are you satisfied with the approach? Okay. We have 25 minutes left and three more agenda items. So what I'll do is we'll move forward with the pension discussion, and then we'll see where we're at the end of that in terms of timing. So I believe Deputy CFO Blair Fishburne will make this presentation. I understand this is your first meeting before the board, so welcome aboard.
Yeah, if you don't mind, Blair Fishburne is our Deputy CFO. He's been here a few months. He's actually came from the Jacksonville Transit as a CFO there and was a CFO at the Pennsylvania Turnpike. So this is his first time presenting, and he's going to talk about the pension and OPEB, which we are recommending some changes to, and he'll take you through that presentation.
Size of the total future obligations of pensions and retiree health care benefits, organizations were accumulating large liabilities with regard to benefits for these employees and retirees. So and the Government Accounting Standards Board in 2008, required that starting in 2008, that OPEB liabilities be reported on public sector financial statements. At Metro, our OPEB expense funding approach has been on a pay-as-you-go basis. We spent about $50 million in fiscal 13. About $55 million this year is projected, and we expect our OPEB costs will be about $60 million in fiscal year 15, next year. And then, excuse me, by 2022, fiscal 2022, we expect that to grow upwards of $100 million if we continue to go on a pay-as-you-go basis. And it's an issue for us because our current future liability for OPEB retiree health benefits for all current retirees and employees is approximately $2 billion, and it's growing. And if we continue on a pay-as-you-go basis, we'll fall further and further behind in our total OPEB liabilities. Therefore, an alternate funding approach is being recommended to begin pre-funding some of our future liability. This involves establishing an irrevocable trust to which annual payments are made and the funds will be invested. And in time, the growth of the deposits and returns on the investments will be sufficient to help offset future pay-as-you-go costs. Once Metro, once we demonstrate that we are consistently contributing to and funding to the OPEB trust, we can get the benefit of higher actuarial assumptions in terms of returns on calculating the future actuarial liability. The actuaries will use an assumption of approximately 4% on returns. But once we continue to consistently contribute to the deposits, to the trust, on a regular basis, those assumptions can raise to as high as 7.5%. And that assumption will then allow that will reduce what the calculation of the future liability will be. And it'll be a more actually realistic reflection of what the actual expected longer-term returns will be from a portfolio that's diversified more with equities. Additional benefits would include positive credit ratings characteristics and strengthening the security of the benefit. We look at, in comparison to our jurisdictional funding partners, we have the largest future unfunded liability, and we've not yet begun to fund it. Our jurisdictional funding partners have, in fact, begun funding theirs. So how do we compare then to our peer transit agencies across the country? Of the eight largest transit agencies in the country, we're among three that have not yet started pre-funding our OPEB obligations. Notably, Chicago entirely pre-funded their future liability with a large debt issue, and that's why you see that they're over 100% funded, and in fact, they have a credit, actually, because of the amount of money that's being generated from their trust investments. The other two that haven't started pre-funding, Boston and Philadelphia, they're in the process of examining and developing funding approaches. So as far as execution of this strategy, we recommend, the GM's proposed budget does have an additional $5 million to start the pre-funding of our OPEB liability in fiscal year 15 budget. And then we would recommend that we increase that by $5 million each year. So in 16 it would be $10 million, in 17 it would be $15 million, and so on. And we continue that for 10 years. And that would be making a total of $275 million of deposits into the OPEB trust fund. The pattern of annually increasing these pre-funding contributions will grow significantly over time. And by 2025, we believe we will have an OPEB liability pre-funding level of approximately 25% of the total liability, and investment earnings that are expected in 2025 should allow us to our annual cost to stabilize at approximately $110 million thereafter. Now, under the pre-funding arrangement I've been discussing, Metro would increase its total OPEB contributions for the 10-year period. We begin to see a return on the investment in 2025 when we stop making pre-funding deposits, and the trust then generates enough money to start reducing our pay-as-you-go amount. In 2025, it'll fall below the level that it would have been had we stayed on a pay-as-you-go basis. And the savings gap between the pre-funding and our current pay-as-you-go method widens as this favorable scenario continues. This would include, once we set up the trust, we would be generating annual reports to the general manager, CFO, and board of directors as part of the operating policy of the trust. on an ongoing basis, we'll be reviewing additional opportunities for managing the structure and costs of OPEB to help manage the future liability. Now, besides funding benefits in the most efficient way, we also want to structure our benefit plans in a way that minimizes our liability. We recommend completing our effort to carve out prescription drug benefits and medical plans and place them with a pharmacy benefit manager. Local 689, 922, and 2 have already started this. And we believe also that once we do that, then we can also apply or set up what's called an employer group waiver plan, which is the most cost-effective way of balancing Medicare eligible retirees' benefits, and we wrap around just an additional amount to keep the benefits the same as what they are, but it's really maximizing the amount of contribution from Medicare. And in total, these steps would save us about $700,000 a year. That is based on the experience that Local 689 has already experienced from starting this back in 2010. And that's all. We achieve all of that with no reduction in benefit levels to existing retirees and the current employees who would be future retirees, of course. In the past 4 years, Local 689, 922, and Local 2 have discounted offering retiree health care coverage for new hires. This is an opportunity for us as well. This would have the benefits from this wouldn't start for a number of years, of course, until the new hires, go through and become retiree eligible. But it is a long-term opportunity for this organization to start reducing costs decades from now and the decades to come. If we look at what the impact that discontinuing the retiree health care for new hires has in terms of savings, recruitment, and retention, on average, this with on a present value basis, on average, once we start getting the benefits after 2025 or so, it would be as much as $4 million a year going forward. I think looking forward to 2050, maybe. We look at recruitment. It doesn't appear that new, there's not a lot of focus that new hires put on in the recruiting process or that we experience from them. They generally focus on what their current compensation package is, what their current health care package is, and then what their pension plan would be. And of course, on a retention basis, it has a little effect once you have employees because we're not changing anything for them. If we look at another opportunity for some savings, it's to increase the minimum service requirement for early retiree health care eligibility to 15 years from 10 years for non-represented employees. This would generate a small amount of annual savings, but it reduces the future liability significantly. And it would affect some active employees so that we would consider probably a phase-in approach with this kind of change, such that we would grandfather in current employees who are within a few years of being eligible for this benefit. And because this affects current employees, we would consider some offsetting benefit improvements in other areas so that we can preserve our overall benefits program that helps us attract and retain good talent. Similarly, looking at savings and recruiting and impact on hiring and retention, the expected savings on a present value basis over the next 20 years would be approximately $200,000 once it starts. That level would start about, 5 to 10 years from now. According to our recruiters in HR, there are a few employees who actually inquire about early retiree eligibility and health care benefits. And we find that most of our employees retire with at least 15 years of service or more, generally. So now lastly, we look at some other opportunities in the area of our trusts. One thing we can do is, once we set up the Metro OPEB Trust, is to consolidate all our retirees, administration of the retiree health care benefits from that trust, and that the existing Health and Welfare Trust would be the administrators of the current health care plans for Local 689, Local 922, and salaried employees. And this would enable also some some future program structural cost improvements to be implemented much more quickly and efficiently when you have all your retirees covered in one single trust. Another thing we're looking at, and we're actually, I believe we are going to be implementing this, and that is to establish a common management trustee position. We have right now 9 different trusts that have 38 trustees, and by establishing a common trustee along that, we can get some consistency in terms of reporting and understanding visibility to the management of all of those trusts, individual trusts. Right now, that position description is being circulated through HR to be finalized. And, of course, we're also carefully looking at the qualifications for such a person because this would be a full-time focus for them. So, in summary, we're committed to providing our employees with competitive pay and strong benefit plans, of course. And at the same time, we have to be committed to keeping costs of those plans within reason. And within our budget constraints. And by implementing these changes, we can meet our goals of providing competitive pay and benefits at reasonable cost. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fishburne. Mr. Chairman. Are there any questions? Mayor Ewell, and then.
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. And certainly this suggestion or the thought to pre-fund is something that's very necessary. For us, WMATA, it's long overdue, but localities have started moving this direction, you know, 4 or 5 years ago or even longer. But it is the right thing to be doing. And so I applaud it and will certainly recognize some savings and returns on investments as a result.
Thank you. Mr. Bulger, then Mr. Dunn.
I thank you very much. Been talking about consolidating pension and trusts, and now we seem to be doing that. I applaud the recommendation that we're going in the consolidated direction that I've been talking about for 2 years. But for that, though, when I first raised this, the union didn't want to do it. Now they are on board.
It is actually, this is our recommendation. We still have to work through with the union community to describe the benefits to them as well as the benefits to Metro. So I think we feel comfortable with that, but that opens up the dialogue, so we're doing that.
So how long do you think that'll take before we know if the unions will accept this consolidated approach that we just heard?
There's two things. So one, we are going forward with a common management trustee. That we don't need the discussion with the union community. So we are doing that. And that'll actually serve to have a consistent management trustee on all the trusts. In terms of your other question, I don't have an answer for that, but I think it's going to be as part of the strategy and the dialogue that we have continuing on with.
All right. Well, then, final question, Mr. Chairman. Something else I've been asking about recently, would this, what are we calling it, centralized, what's the term?
The Metro OPEB Trust for retirees?
The person we're going to hire.
Oh, the common management trustee, right.
All right, will that trustee, common benefit trustee, will that person report to the board or report to Rich?
Currently, it's a direct report to the CFO. They will have reporting in the job description. They will have reporting obligations to the CEO, to the CFO, and to the board. So
could I make a suggestion just to chew on that person at least once a year report something to the board or in the budget process or so we know who that person is and how things are going and how everything is working smoothly and we're saving money, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you. Mr. Dowdy, then Mr. Downs.
Yeah, a question on
Mr. Dowdy. I just want to make a comment. The trust that we're talking about are really the health trusts.
I understand. Yeah.
It is not the pension trust. That's different. That we feel like the pension trust consolidation has actually a pretty good chance of happening in the discussions with the health one. I'm sorry. Health.
Still got to work on the pension.
I know. We still have to work on the pension trust. So.
Mr. Dowdy.
A question on the retiree health benefits. Now, as I understand it, new employees coming on board do not get retiree health benefits. Is that
currently they do?
Currently they do, but as I saw the chart, it says those hired mm-hmm. since a certain date.
For non-rep employees.
Yeah, non-rep do not. And non-rep get them. Union employees do not get retiree health for those who are starting now. What options do those people have? I know you say people don't think about this when they're hiring on at age 25, but as they get closer, the gap between our retirement age and Medicare eligibility, what options will those people have? Paid continuation of existing plan, Affordable Care Act, or no coverage?
And I'm going to have Jim Davis, and I apologize for not introducing. Jim Davis is the pension health retiree defined benefit plan manager, and he can address that question. Jim.
For the new retirees and the three unions that do not have retiree eligibility that are hiring in now, we do not currently have opportunities for them. The whole basis for this kind of movement being undertaken by a number of employers and organizations is that the Affordable Care Act, the whole structure of the health exchanges, is intended to provide a fair means of all employee or all citizens being able to get insurance. So the burden would somewhat come off of the employer to continue that existing arrangement.
So this person who retires at age 55 would have to go into the exchange, or if they're going on to another career, another employer, receive help from those, but we would have no obligation to them post their retirement.
That's what we would anticipate at this time.
Yeah. It's a long time away.
It's going to be many years until we see it, and in a sense that's a real bonus because I wouldn't want to have to send a whole lot of people to an exchange today, but I hope that I would feel differently a few years from now.
Thank you. Mr. Downs.
The way of calculating liability in this environment about OPEB is all current employees plus all future employees who are going to be entitled to a benefit. Stopping the benefit for new hires either in 2010 or 2012 significantly changes that liability going forward. Has there been a calculation about the cumulative effect of stopping the non-representative retirement benefit going forward? The other is a traditional calculation is to calculate that liability against forecasted turnover within the workforce because people who don't make it to retirement don't qualify for OPEB, and our turnover has been significant over time, and the calculation of this liability should be showing forecasted in the out years significant declines in liability, and I'm not sure I see that. The last question is there an assumption that we will be continuing PAYGO in this process through that entire period that is shown on that chart with the decline, and only in the 12th year seeing some decline in PAYGO?
There were a number of questions there.
Yes.
If I can remember at least. First, the change in the liability, the OPEB liability, for not providing eligibility to your new hire for retiree insurance doesn't help your OPEB liability much initially, in the long term, it does. So that's one. Secondly, the chart that we showed estimated that the impact of eliminating retiree eligibility for the non-represented employees would have roughly a $4 million a year impact on the year. Thirdly, the impact on the attractiveness of the benefits program or the ability to attract new talent, we, in talking with the recruiters, the information we got was rarely does the question of retiring medical come up in the discussion. The employees are tend to focus much more on the current liability. That's a little different if you have a mature employee, but it's quite often the case for us.
Well, again, talking with human resource representatives about the turnover issue, there isn't the sense that that's going to be a significant factor very often.
I think the point is that it's an actuarial assumption issue, and we would go back and have a conversation with our actuary, Aon, talk about what their how they factor in.
The last question, actually, we assume that we would be contributing. The contribution would happen every year, $5 million until we get to 2025.
Increase it by
$5 million. Well, it happens to be the same. We were happy that it was the same year because it was significant.
The last question. I get posed to the general manager, and I copy the creation of a special chapter within the budget that deals only with pension and PPP liabilities. 10% of our operating budget will increase as we add the amounts required to establish this fund. We have a review of each pension fund on an annual basis, its returns, its expenses, its return for 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, to limit the liability still within each of the funds for full funding. I would, most businesses and most governments now go out of their way to make clear in a public document usually their budgets.
The statement of pension liability and contributions, returns, expenses. We don't have that the way our budget is structured now, and it needs to be part, I think, of an adopted budget process and a budget expense for the coming year.
We will definitely lift what we do in a very detailed way. What you described is in our financial statements.
I'm not talking about financial statements.
As I said, we will lift that and put it on a budget perspective so that you can have, we will have the chapter as you described it, and we can look at it from a planning and a budget perspective. We'll have that programmatic view for you.
A financial statement is not the same thing as a transparent review of performance by fund, expenses, returns, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year. It doesn't give the kind of transparency that this particular issue requires in a public budget document. We have buried it, and it allows too much potential for financial manipulation over time, and we've proven over our past to have been willing to manipulate the pension funds for a variety of reasons. The only cure for that is sunshine. It is daylight. And to have accountability in the budget on an annual basis is, I think, the only way the board can deal with that as part of its budget. And I'd be willing to make a motion to include that in the budget.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion about, I mean, I guess the, maybe I'll let the staff respond to this. Do you? I mean, Mr. Downs has raised a.
I totally agree,
okay.
And we have used to have a view of the pension, and we highlighted it in the budget in the past. We've changed the view of that. I'm in total support of that, and we can easily do that and have it on a programmatic view and have it very much front and center on our budget discussions. Yes.
Thank you.
So this person that we're going to hire on, and it's in this chart that's in our documents.
You need your glasses.
And that person, no, I don't need my glasses. That person will be the spokesperson to tell us how all the current pension programs are working, per Mr. Downs's eloquent statement. And as we go forward, we learn more about how they're operating, how they're doing, how they're benchmarked, what the metrics are, who they hired or didn't hire, who they got rid of as investment managers, et cetera, et cetera. Great. Thank you.
We actually have thrown a motion and a second on the table.
So
I think we've...
Will you withdraw it?
Withdraw the motion. We'll proceed with the report. Okay. Ms. Porter, then we need to end this meeting because we have to move forward.
I certainly am not as expert in these matters as my colleagues who have worked on transit systems for many more years. But if you look at the first chart in the appendix, which lays out the amount of PAYGO, which is our current contribution, and then the additional plan contribution, and lays it out for a number of years through 2032. As you mentioned in your presentation, it looks like we end up paying more through 2024 when we're paying essentially $160 million total, the one before that, when we're ending up paying $160 million. And then in 2025, we go to paying less than we would under a PAYGO situation. How confident are you in the scenario? Are there things out there, either in changes in calculation, changes in the environment, that could change this list? The concern I have is we're putting up the money up front, and we're assuming that 12 years down the road, 10 years down the road, we will be seeing a benefit. How sure are you that that's what's actually going to happen? Are there things that could change this, either making the year that we start seeing a reduction in our costs a different year, or something that could change this scenario in a significant way? I mean, I don't even know what to suggest it could be, but I just know that in these kinds of analyses, there are certain assumptions that go into it. And if those assumptions, if something doesn't go according to whatever those assumptions are, this would look, and it could look significantly different.
Correct. That's right. And these are these projections that are produced by our actuary, and they use various assumptions on retirement rates and cost of healthcare costs, inflation, life expectancy, things like that, and certain investment returns on that. And those are all certainly variables, but they take the best guess, you know, sort of a central probability of those assumptions and produce these reports. That if you give them different assumptions, certainly the cash flow view could change substantially. But also, as far as an important point is that the nature of a Section 115 trust, a revocable trust, is that the money that goes in there can't be used for anything else other than paying for these retiree health care costs. That money is protected, and of course, if we do these other things with the common management trustee and have visibility to it, we will ensure that that the investments not only protected, but we're maximizing the returns on those, so we can start seeing this kind of contribution reduction in our future PAYGO costs.
Okay, given that the assumptions that we're making are not likely to exactly comport with reality when it comes about, how likely is this scenario to be very close to what actually happens? Do you think it's very likely, sort of likely?
Highly likely, if the assumptions that the actuary used, but we have to make these deposits, we have to make this commitment as a policy to make these kind of pre-funding deposits every year, annually, and still cover our PAYGO costs simultaneously.
Okay, I guess what I'm looking for is not, I believe that the assumptions you made are correct. I'm willing to believe that. I'm sure you have enough expertise in this to do that. The question I'm more asking is, in the general field of making these kinds of projections. How commonly are they exactly correct?
I don't know. I don't think I know the answer. That's a question our actuary may have to answer, or maybe Jim knows.
That question is not answerable, I don't think. But what I can tell you is that the government required, Government Accounting Standards Board, statement number 45 requires that an evaluation of your OPEB liability be done every 2 years. And these scenarios were run directly from the report, the most recent report. So they conform to all the requirements that are in Government Accounting Standards Board number 45.
Mr. Downey.
So it's as good as it can be, I guess.
Being mindful of time. So Mr. Downey, then Mrs. Hines, and then I think we'll need to end it. To
yeah, on. Just following up on that and the previous. If we have, as we expect now to have, a budget, a pension and OPEB chapter in the budget, we will have the basis to look each year at what the projections are and where they're going. And with respect to that chapter, are you saying we will see it in the budget we adopt this year?
Yeah,
and then for future years, we'd have the opportunity to tweak what's there. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mrs. Hines.
Thank you. To follow up on Kathy's question, but to ask something slightly different, when you showed us the comparators of other transit agencies in both of the regional jurisdictions, all of us who have set up these trusts are operating with a series of assumptions, particularly around rate of return. And rate of return is from my, you know, small amount of experience, the thing where it's best if we're all more or less in the same ballpark. And so I'm wondering whether you can bring us back something that helps us understand, you know, not how everybody, but how some others have constructed their OPEB assumptions so that we have some sense. You know, for a while we were all using 8 or 8.5% as rate of return on the market. We know now that's too high. But I don't know where other people have landed. And so to me, that gets closest to Kathy's question of, are we going to be in the same boat with everybody else in terms of how the market performs?
Okay, thank you. Any other quick questions? If not, we will have to forego the progress reports so we can move forward with our other items for the entire board. So I will note that you do have written reports in the packet, and we'll talk about whether we should reschedule that or not. Any other questions, Mr. Dale?
A question about process. Is the staff requesting the board to formalize the decision about the limitation on future non-represented employees on retiree health care?
It's just a recommendation. We haven't put forth anything for board, a formal board approval yet.
You will bring that to the committee soon?
Next
timetable?
March.
March.
Okay. April? After budget option? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Next few months?
Okay. Any other questions? Not this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.